From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the governor's ultimatum to the Benton Harbor schools: close the failing high school or risk having the entire district dissolved.
I think this is the governor saying, if the board isn't going to do something that the state wants them to do, in this case, shut down the high school, then they will flex their muscles and do the dissolution.
On the eve of the Women's World Cup 2019, high praise for what U.S. women have done for soccer.
So women actually in the United States are not only pioneers as women in the sport of soccer, but in fact for the culture of soccer.
And the Soapbox Derby's coming back to Flint and people are excited.
People looking me up or getting a hold of me and saying, I used to race and I really want my son or grandson or daughter or granddaughter to be a part of this as well.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello there and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, we look at one of the major reasons for the rise of soccer and its popularity in the United States. Ahead of the Women's World Cup, we talk about the influence of women on the so-called beautiful game. That's later in the program. But first, the clock is ticking for Benton Harbor High School. That's the message Governor Whitmer brought to worried people in the southwest Michigan city last night. She told local leaders they've got until June 14th to submit a plan to keep their high school open. The state says the district is $18.4 million in debt. It could run out of money by next spring. And if Benton area schools cannot reach an agreement with the state over its debt, the entire district could be dissolved. It's all hitting students pretty hard.
They can't close our school. It ain't no community without our school. Like, we the Tigers. What we gonna beat in? I was at this high school first. My parents graduated from this high school. My parents just graduated from the other high school. This other high schools don't mean nothing to me. This is where I was raised from, so this is where I prefer to graduate from.
I just want this school to stay up, and I'm going to keep it up, too. I have no type of negativity that this school is going to get shut down or any type of thing like that. It's not going to get shut down. I got faith that it's not going to shut down. It's just not going to shut down.
You look at us as a target when it's a lot of people in a lot of different cities that's going under the same pressure as us, and we're the light. We're the leaders. We want to be the individuals that make them stand up, the people that make them get up, no matter what it takes. If I have to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning to be at a meeting, I don't care. I will be there.
You got to get up and put your hands in the air.
Yeah.
Say, I believe.
I believe. I believe.
I believe.
I believe.
I believe.
I believe.
I believe.
I believe.
I believe.
I believe.
I believe.
I believe.
I believe.
I believe.
I believe.
I believe.
You heard from Benton Harbor students LaCorian Traver, Cameron Gordon, and Deasia Spencer. So how is Michigan's track record when it takes over school districts and gets this involved? Craig Thiel of the nonpartisan Citizens Research Council of Michigan is with us. Craig, just last year, the Benton Harbor District signed a cooperative agreement with the state. It put a CEO in charge of the district and then gave him till 2023 to right the ship on finances and academics. So why is Governor Whitmer stepping in now?
Well, Cindy, last year during the lame duck session in the Michigan legislature, the law that undergirded the cooperative agreement was eliminated. This was the law putting in place a state school reform officer, and so the powers of that person will expire on July 1, and therefore this cooperative agreement between the state and Benton Harbor Schools for the financial and academic plan that you mentioned was going to extend out for about 5 years is eliminated. So this offers an opportunity for Governor Whitmer to reexamine the approach to dealing with Benton Harbor's academic and financial challenges.
Okay, and here the governor is giving the Benton Harbor School Board one more week to, you know, shut down the high school, turn the district into K through 8. And if the board does not give the go-ahead, the state treasury is saying the entire district could be forced to dissolve. Why is that?
Well, ultimately, it's up to the local board to decide what to do with schools, with one exception. We passed a law, the state of Michigan passed a law in 2013 that allows the state treasurer, with the help of the state superintendent for public instruction, to step in and dissolve an entire school district. This was done in the summer of 2013. Primarily to deal with two school districts, Inkster and Buena Vista, and they were dissolved in the summer of 2013, and the students from those districts were reassigned to neighboring school districts, and the education of those students happened outside of Buena Vista and Inkster beginning in the fall of 2013.
Are there any other options for the state or the district, or does state law require the governor to step in?
State law doesn't require the governor to step in here. I think this is the governor saying, if the board isn't going to do something that the state wants them to do, in this case, shut down the high school and just concentrate on K-8, then they will flex their muscles and do the dissolution. This is something that, you know, hasn't been used since 2013. There's also on the books the emergency manager law that was put in place decades ago and went through a number of revisions about 10 years ago. But the emergency manager law is another avenue that the governor could pursue to deal with the financial and academic challenges in Benton Harbor.
Craig, would closing the high school be likely to help the district to right itself both financially and certainly academically, where things are very dire? Is there any evidence doing that will work?
It's hard to say. We don't have an experience necessarily here, a direct one-to-one comparison to draw on. I would point out that if you close the high school and the students go to another district, you lose the revenue with those students. So you're not necessarily just losing the expense, but you're also losing the revenue. So on the financial side, I don't see the math adding up there. On the academic side, the neighboring districts likely are going to provide a different opportunity for these students. Whether or not those students flourish will probably be contingent on, you know, what their needs are and if those districts can meet those specific needs. Again, we don't have a clear case study to draw on to say it will work in Benton Harbor. I mean, there's hope that it'll improve the academic progress of these students, but there's no guarantee.
You know, Craig, back in 2017, we all remember the state threatened to close dozens of schools for poor academic performance. And eventually then State Superintendent Brian Whiston came up with this alternative plan for partnership districts that gave districts 3 years to turn around failing schools. Why isn't the state offering that option to Benton Harbor High School?
Well, I think the state would offer that opportunity, and I think at the time, Benton Harbor was contemplated to be a partnership district. The cooperative agreement, however, gives a little longer of a time frame. It puts in place a single figurehead, in this case it was the CEO, to run the school district, to take the powers that the school board had and the superintendent would have and put them all in a CEO. And again, when the law was passed in lame duck eliminating the authority for this cooperative agreement, it basically ended the opportunity for the cooperative agreement to finish out its time. If the control of the school district rolls over to the school board on July 1 when this law comes on, it's likely that the Department of Ed will offer them a partnership. I think the governor's looking to come up with another plan prior to that, and that's this closing of the high school.
So the partnership could be something that we might see evolve.
It might be. It's likely that that will be part of what you know, the governor's proposing as well for the K-8 program at Benton Harbor, to enter into a partnership agreement with the Department of Ed, with the local intermediate school district, with other stakeholders in the community down there in Benton Harbor.
Craig Thiel, let's open up the lens a little bit. How effective has the state been in intervening in failing schools through Michigan in the past?
Kind of a mixed bag here, Cindy. I think with the finances, there's probably been a little more success in dealing with challenged school districts. On the academics, the verdict is still out on that one. We've seen in Buena Vista and Inkster, we talked about earlier, those students, when they lost their school districts, were assigned to neighboring districts that weren't necessarily any better academically than what they left. So that can be a challenge. You know, it depends on where the school district is located, whether or not the neighboring districts are going to provide a better opportunity for students. In Benton Harbor, there is some hope that that would be the case with the access to, I think, 8 to 10 different school districts, as well as the local community college to provide services. In Inkster and Buena Vista, it was a much more limited opportunity for students, so greater choice, I think, is available in Benton Harbor. So it's a mixed bag, I think, overall on the dissolution process that we've used in Michigan.
Are there success stories that you could point to, a case or two where the state has jumped in and intervened over finances or academics, and schools or students, even more importantly, did wind up better off?
We did see something similar with the Detroit Public School bailout and the legislation that went through in 2016 that dissolved the old school district, creating a new public school in its place. The finances seemed to be on the right track in Detroit Public Schools. They returned control of the district from an emergency manager over to a elected board who hired a new superintendent, and progress is being made, although it's early to see, you know, how much the needles move in DPS, but clearly there are some good things happening there. So there is some hope, but Detroit was probably a much larger lift than what's going on in Benton Harbor, just in terms of scale, I think. But in terms of, you know, a specific Benton Harbor comparison, it's hard to make one.
But Benton Harbor is certainly not the only district in this state struggling with finances, struggling with academics. Would you expect to see more interventions from the state like this one that's playing out now in Benton Harbor?
I've seen the state actually ratcheting down its interventions. Under the last administration, the plan was to kind of get out of the business of the emergency manager. In fact, the Benton Harbor district, right before the last administration left office, ended a consent agreement that was in place between the district and the state to deal with the finances there. So it's hard to see whether or not this new administration is going to want to turn the tide and start intervening in school districts' finances directly as what has been the case under the previous administration.
Craig Thiel, Citizens Research Council of Michigan. It's always great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, the planned merger between Fiat Chrysler and French auto giant Renault would have made it the third largest automaker in the world. But last night, the deal fell apart. We'll find out why and what it means for Michigan after the break. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We turn now to a problem proving to be a hindrance to student success: internet access. More and more schoolwork is online these days, but some students across the country are falling behind their peers because they don't have internet access at home. Schools are now coming up with their own workarounds for internet access. Interlochen Public Radio's Taylor Wisner reports.
When Cora Hopper used to go on the internet for her homework, it usually ended in frustration.
We were in the middle and it would like just slow down automatically, just like randomly stop and have to like reload, or you'd have to exit out of the page and redo it.
Cora is a sandy blonde-haired 12-year-old who lives in Engadine, a rural logging and mining town in the Upper Peninsula. She was sharing dial-up internet with her 5 siblings and her dad. Each day they took turns on the computer, and Cora would sometimes have to wait until late at night to start her assignments. A recent Pew Research study found that 15% of students in the U.S. don't have access to reliable high-speed internet at home. Education researchers call it the homework gap. They found that students who don't have access tend to do worse in school and score lower on standardized tests. Rutgers University professor Vicki Katz co-authored a study on the homework gap in 2016. She says lower-income kids are more likely to be learning how to do basic skills on a computer.
You know, how to open Google Documents and how to type into them, as opposed to learning how to create things or develop robotics, which their higher income peers are doing in many parts of the country.
Kat says schools have been on the front lines trying to fill internet access gaps for their students. Some schools have opened computer labs early in the morning, while others have installed Wi-Fi hotspots on buses. Northern Michigan University has taken it a step further. It has special permission to use a little-known spectrum called the Educational Broadband Service, reserved by the government for educational purposes. Eric Smith, who runs the broadband program there, says he first used the radio spectrum to bring Wi-Fi to its off-campus students. And then it blossomed to 61 underserved communities all across the UP.
Our interest is in having them be able to access their educational needs so that they can become more productive, better citizens, and make them better contributors to their communities.
Smith says in the 60s, the government set aside the frequency for schools, but didn't have a great plan to regulate it. So in the 90s, the FCC stopped giving it away. Besides NMU, only two school districts in California and one in Virginia also use it to create their own internet networks. Fast forward to 3 months ago when it went live in the tiny town of Engadine. That meant anyone living within 9 miles of the local school got internet service for only $20 to $35 a month. Now, Cora says she doesn't have to wait to do her homework anymore, and having more access has helped her with things like math and essay writing.
I had to write about about books I read, like The Diary of Anne Frank and Milkweed. So like I would look up things that I couldn't remember or more facts about them.
But Cora's classmate, Michaela Avery, still doesn't have internet access at home, so she tries to get her homework done in class.
You try to work as much as you can and try to do it as fast as you can without being distracted or anything like that.
Now the university wants to bring the service to 54 communities over the next year. Eric Smith says the spectrum is extremely valuable because it recently moved to LTE and 5G technology. Meanwhile, the FCC is reconsidering how to dole out the radio spectrum. And Smith fears a bidding war with private companies who may not lease out the spectrum at a rate schools can afford.
If we lose that building block, if that's not available, then it takes away an important tool that educators have to make sure that people receive the education they're entitled to.
A tool that can bring online learning to students no matter where they live. For Stateside, I'm Taylor Wisner.
It looks like the corporate marriage proposal is off. Fiat Chrysler announced late last night it's withdrawing from the $37 billion merger deal with Renault, a deal that would have created the world's third largest automaker. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is here to explain just how things went south. Did anyone see this coming?
Yine, I think.
Yine?
in the sense, as the Germans would say, yes and no. Okay. Listen, the elephant in the room in all of this has been the French government, who owns 15% of Renault, and clearly is determined to make sure that whatever happens here, Renault ends up just a little bit on top of the whole situation. And as they work together, the companies, and talking to some sources, very high-level sources who are in Paris and were around for this whole thing, they continue to work this what they called a delicate balance between the two companies as they moved ahead with this 50-50 merger. And it seemed like every time they encountered little bumps in the road and then they'd work them out between the two managements, the government representatives would kind of stick their thumb on the scale and say, well, we want another board seat. Well, we want to be on the four-person panel that's going to name the next several CEOs. We think Renault should be getting more money instead of a cash dividend going to FCA shareholders only. And finally, Mike Manley, the CEO, and John Elkann, the chairman of Fiat Chrysler, essentially said, if this is the way this company is going to be run going forward, we're out.
Okay, because remember, you and I talked when this was announced about how poisonous that Daimler-Benz deal was for Chrysler, the merger of equals that sure wasn't. They didn't want to have history repeat itself.
And they made sure that the phrase for merger of equals was nowhere in any of the internal or external paper that they were preparing. Hmm. By some accounts, at least, they were getting along very well here. And the other irony is the French government was then worried about Nissan and the partner of Nissan to Renault when Nissan was never a party to these discussions. And the irony of that is the Nissan people are on the sidelines complaining about the fact that they're not involved, but they're the ones who were resisting Renault's attempt to try and bring the alliance further into a potential merger, because then the Japanese company would be essentially run out of Paris.
Okay.
And they didn't want that.
So there were a lot of movable parts.
So it's
here.
Like, I don't want to be part of you, but I'm mad that you don't have me involved in the discussions with FCA. It's childish, frankly. But ultimately, I think this is a telling point here. The government ownership of some of these companies is a deal killer. I mean, if anybody would go to try to do a deal, a true merger with Volkswagen, the same thing would happen. It's 20% owned by the state of Lower Saxony. They have their own political ends as to why they maintain that stake. and they are safeguarding jobs in their state or in that their part of Germany, or in this case, in France. One of the other things they wanted was a guarantee against job cuts in France.
Well, of course, because those French labor unions are powerful, but those are the plants that are running under capacity.
Exactly. You get an A. It's exactly right.
Thank you.
And in Italy, the same thing. Yeah. The exact same thing. And the Italians are just as outspoken about closing of plants. So you have two of the worst automakers in terms of underutilized capacity somehow joining forces and saying, we can join forces and save a lot of money, but we're not going to take out any plants or any shifts or any people.
And if you stop and think about merging all of that, wouldn't it be a bloated beast of a company if it didn't have some streamlining and plant closings?
Of course it would. And who would be generating all the cash? The Americans.
There you go. Yeah, there you go. Well, all right. So here's a question, Daniel. How worrisome is this for people who get their paychecks because of FCA, the suppliers and the employees of FCA? Can FCA survive without a partner?
Well, they're already saying, yes, we can, which they're going back to the mantra that actually was a Sergio Marchionne mantra and Mike Manley has adopted, which is we can go it alone, but we will always look at opportunities.
Because Marchionne was constantly on the hunt for the right partner.
Yes, in 2015, his Confessions of a Capital Junkie, which was a presentation he made to financial analysts, basically argued that there needed to be consolidation within the industry. There's too much duplication on a lot of things that are not important to customers, not transformative to the business. Like everybody's got a four-cylinder engine, for example. Why do we need everybody making a four-cylinder engine? Can't we combine and have, you know, two four-cylinder engines for the entire world? But a lot of companies say, no, ours is better. Ours is proprietary. We're going to do it our way. So they continue to put money into it. But I don't think there's any question. This was a Marchionne Confessions of a Capital Junkie play. That's mm-hmm. what this was. Mm-hmm. You know, do they start negotiations again with PSA, also a French company? There's little to no government ownership of PSA. I know that the government was winding down their ownership there.
And just remind us who PSA is.
PSA is the maker of Peugeot and Citroën cars. They are not currently in the United States. They are looking at entering the United States market again. They recently bought Opel and Vauxhall from General Motors after 90 years being owned by GM. And in less than 2 years, they turned it around and made it profitable. But some of my sources in Germany that I've talked to recently have told me that a lot of the engineering that's in Germany is being hollowed out and being taken back to France.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel House. Thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
It has been 25 years since an official soapbox derby race happened in Flint, and that changes this Saturday. 12 kids will climb into their homemade, unmotorized race cars and zoom down a track just the way their grandparents or great-grandparents might have done. The winner gets to compete in the All-American Soapbox Derby race happening next month in Akron, Ohio, where the race has been held every year since 1935.
Every spring, in thousands of attics, garages, and basements throughout the country, thousands of young Americans set to work building their entries for the All-American Soapbox Derby.
Joining us now is Kevin Cronin, founder of the Flint Soapbox Derby. It's been some 25 years now since a sanctioned race happened in Flint and a decade since one happened in Michigan?
Yeah, it has.
What happened? I remember this as a kid. It was a big deal.
You know, that's anybody's guess, and I wish I had a good answer to you, but I'm not sure. I never grew up racing. I always knew about it. I had a car. We would just kind of, you know, my family would just go to the local hill and just kind of go down it. But in terms of a race, there wasn't one, and I'm not sure why. So that's one of the excitements I have in bringing this back now.
And why did you decide the time was right to bring it back?
It's been an idea that I've had in the back of my mind for a while, always kind of having that familiarity, but never being a participant as a kid. And it's just something I always thought would be a lot of fun, very engaging, very collaborative. And it's just something that we kind of started pushing forward once I learned about some community opportunities in terms of park adoption and just things that you can get a little more involved in the community.
So a way to bring kids together. And you say you never raced, but you've got a kind of a family history, don't you, in Flint with Soapbox Derby?
I do, yeah. The hill, the track is actually named after my grandfather, and he was mayor of Flint at the time when it was built in 1969.
So I'm looking at the Donald R. Cronin Soapbox Derby Downs. So how many cities actually have their own soapbox park and track?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. Yeah. It's definitely an asset. It's definitely an advantage. And I think it's a good thing that can bring additional participation to Flint and make the Flint race even bigger.
And so explain to us, for those who were not around to remember how this worked, mm-hmm. when they were kids, these racers, they got to build their own car.
They have to build their own car. That's right. What we're doing now, since it's a sanctioned race through the All-American Soapbox Derby, they actually have kits that you can purchase from Akron. So we picked those up from Akron, drove them back, and then we hosted building workshops for the first three Saturdays in May, where kids came and we had great instructors from that either grew up in Akron, our race director, or that live in Akron now and are very familiar with the race, know how to build, and have done an exceptional job with it.
Now, you've never raced. What do you hear from people who were involved? When was the Soapbox Derby really at the height of its popularity in Michigan, and what was that like?
The height of the popularity would have been the late 70s to the early to mid 80s, and that's when the city of Flint produced three world champions in a six-year period from 78 to 83, and just the crowd size, the enthusiasm, and everybody kind of from that time period as they started reaching out to me as well, too, talking about what a great experience that was.
And there is a lot of emotion and history attached to that. You heard something from from a man who was helping during one of these Build Saturdays that kind of stuck in your mind.
Yeah, it really did. And he reached out to me just as word was getting out and just called and was really interested in and was talking to me about his experience growing up. And he was actually the 1982 local Flint champ. But we were just having a conversation about racing and about the Soapbox Derby. And he just kind of unprovoked opened up to me and said, "The Flint Soapbox Derby saved my life," and just talking about different challenges he had going on at home and how he's able to work on the car as a way to kind of distract and learn other things. And it was just, you know, it was really touching and really heartfelt. And I knew that this is really just something that's more than a race and can be a really powerful thing for the community.
So the cars are built. Have people done test drives down the track to get an idea how the do you get a chance to test your car out?
So we have had a chance to test the car out, not at the track or where the course will be, because for this one will be a city street, which we have to close the street. So we haven't had an opportunity.
And you need an angle.
You need an angle. Yeah. That's right.
No engines. It's all gravity.
Right. Yeah. No angle. So our last building workshop, we took the cars out just to a near street with a little bit of a hill, and it wasn't a very long course, but we were just able to push them down that and let them get some familiarity with it, which was made for a really great day.
So you've got to get in a straight line. You're not steering. You are just going down the hill.
Yeah. I mean, the idea is to go in a straight line. There is a steering wheel in there, and you may have to modify and adjust a little bit. But, I mean, these wide, you know, 90-degree turns, you're certainly not going to make.
How fast do they go?
They can go, it ranges kind of by the hill and by the way, how well the car is built as well, too. But I think an average is going to be about 25 miles an hour. So they go pretty fast.
Now you say you have to use the city street. Is that because the Donald R. Cronin Soapbox Derby Downs is not up for competition at this point?
Yeah, it's in need of repair. In other ways, they say it's definitely a Michigan road. That's a joke that I've heard a couple times. So it needs work, and that's something that once we get this first race underway, which hopefully will be a great day, I think it will be. We're definitely looking forward to growing the race even bigger.
There's such a long history. You're almost at you're pushing a century since a newspaper reporter in Akron saw some kids in 1933 with their homemade cars and said, "Hey, let's start this." And which is then in 1934, the first Soapbox Derby race was run. It's old school. It is old school. And kids today have, let's just say, lots more entertainment options. Yeah. Could you tear kids away from their iPads or their video games? Did you have any problem getting contestants?
No, we did not. In fact, what we're going to do is we're going to have the sanctioned race, which is limited by the amount of vehicles we have. So only 12 cars, meaning only 12 kids for that. We had 35 participants each workshop. So once that race is over, we're going to allow those other kids that aren't able to race in the sanctioned race to go down the hill as well and have an open racing segment. And then anybody else that wants to just check it out and race as well will have that opportunity later in the day. So
kind of grow it. Start planting seeds.
Exactly.
I know what you see.
Right.
I see you. I know what you do. What about volunteers? How did the community jump into support?
So we've got volunteers through our sponsors that have been very welcoming and very forthcoming and very encouraging and enthusiastic. The same that can be said for the community as well, too, for community partners, but those that either raced growing up or have a familiarity or really just are really interested in automotives. You know, anybody is more than welcome to come out, and we will definitely put you to work, too.
I'm interested if there are any dads whose kids might now be
racing. Do you have any generational ties?
There are some generational ties as well, too, and I think that we'll get some more as well. Mm-hmm. The closer we get to race date, the more I hear people looking me up or getting a hold of me and saying, I used to race, and I really want my son or daughter or granddaughter to be a part of this as well. So.
Because I remember it was, I want to say maybe the 70s when Soapbox Derby opened up racing to girls to be able to compete as well. So
that, yeah.
Something
it's
like
not,
that.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so there we go. So are you kind of hoping to be the catalyst to revive Soapbox Derbies, maybe not just in Flint, but to kind of get this spread through Michigan and get Michigan on board again?
I hope so. It is great to have it across the state. It's great to have various races where kids can go to, so it's not just Flint, where if there's a closer in proximity that, and really just a more opportunity as well, too. If one weekend doesn't work, summers are busy now. They're able to do it in other places and other cities and, even maybe just get a feel for a part of the state that they're not exposed to as well.
And then, of course, your winner is going on to Akron for the big championship. They have pulled in some big names through the years in Akron for that big championship.
Yep, that they have. And in Flint, we've had three racers that have gone on to win the championship there in a six-year period, actually, between 1978 and 1983. So it's a big thing. And of all the big names that have been there, it's great to have another Flint name there.
Well, there we go. Well, the Flint Soapbox Derby will be this Saturday, June 8th. And you can get all the details very easily by going to flintsoapbox.org. Again, that is flintsoapbox.org. Kevin Cronin, Flint Soapbox Derby, with the great slogan, "It's all downhill from here."
That's right.
Thanks so much, Kevin.
Thanks very much for having me.
After the break, why testing the sense of smell in older people could be a valuable part of their health screening. Plus, we look at the history of women in American soccer. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. How is your sense of smell? A new Michigan State University study suggests that question could become a valuable part of health screening in older people. Let's find out why as we welcome Michigan State University epidemiologist Hongli Chen, who has been studying just what our sense of smell could tell us about our life expectancy. Welcome to the program. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Cindy.
So what was the goal of your research? What's the question you wanted to answer?
So I study Parkinson's disease. I started my research looking into the potential causes for Parkinson's. And it turns out in the past maybe 20 years, evidence suggests that a person's smell is probably one of the earliest and most important symptoms for Parkinson's disease. And later, there are also evidence suggesting it's an early symptom for Alzheimer's disease and dementia. So that's how I get interested in a person's smell. And I'm trying to understand what person's smell means in the elderly population as far as neurodegenerative diseases, and these are Parkinson's and Alzheimer's, are concerned, and also beyond.
So you're comparing older adults and their sense of smell. Who's got a good sense of smell and whose sense of smell has diminished?
Exactly. We use some really simple test to examine their sense of smell. We call this a screening test for their sense of smell identification. And we classify based on the result into good sense of smell and poor sense of smell and also somebody in between.
So how did they compare? What did you discover?
So we reported in the past, I think in 2017, that a person's smell was associated with higher risk for both Parkinson's and dementia in this particular cohort. And later, we are interested in looking at its relationship to mortality because other studies suggested an association not as strong as it is for Parkinson's or dementia, but it's an association with higher risk for death among older adults with person's smell. But the previous studies only look at a five-year mortality, which means they follow up the study participant for 5 years or less. And we are interested to look into the association in relatively long term. Again, we are studying older adults, so we cannot go very long. In this analysis, we analyze data for up to 13 years of follow-up in this cohort. And what we found out is older adults with a poor smell that they performed badly on this test had about 46% higher mortality, that means higher risk for death in 10 years compared to old adults who tested normal in their sense of smell. And also we look into the potential explanations which have not been examined systematically in the previous studies.
Okay, so just to really wrap our mind around this, so if you're an adult between ages 71 and 82, that was the age group you studied, these thousands of people. So if you have a poor sense of smell, you may have an almost 50% higher risk of dying within 10 years. And that's even if you're healthy.
Exactly. Actually, it's interesting because we identified this association largely limited to people who self-identified as healthy, which means they reported good to excellent health status at the beginning of the follow-up. And that's really intriguing.
So what do you think is the reason for this?
I think it's probably because for those who had a self-evaluation of good to excellent health, there might be something going on at the end of their life that the sense of smell can tell us, but they have not recognized these health issues themselves. And among people who already have poor health status, probably the sense of smell is relatively less important as compared to the many things going on in their health.
So it sounds like you're saying this sense of smell could be that proverbial canary in a coal mine, the early warning sign, in a sense, that things are not as well as you may think they are.
It could be.
What do we do with this research? How do you want it to be used?
So what I'm thinking about, we need to find out what a poor smell means in the old adults beyond our understanding of neurodegeneration, which is Parkinson's and Alzheimer's and diseases alike. Because in the study, we only identified of the higher risk associated with poor sense of smell, only about 30% could be explained by dementia, Parkinson's, and weight loss. And there are 70% of the higher risk, we don't know what they are about. So I think we need to understand what a poor sense of smell really means in the older adults population. And we can start from there and think about what the health implications that will be and do something about it.
Because it strikes me that this is early. So if I'm, let's say I'm not, but let's just say I'm 75, I'm in this cohort that you studied, and I don't feel like I'm smelling things the way I used to. Is there anything that I can do about that or present to my doctor and tell them that? Can they make connections, or is it still too early in the research to kind of know what to look for?
I think it's still a little bit early to know exactly what we are looking for, because the poor sense of smell in the old adults is pretty common, affecting about 25% of old adults 65 years or older. And if we are talking about 80 years or older, the percentage is very high. So I think we need to understand what exactly a poor sense of smell means in the old adults, and to the extent possible, identify the potential causes. It could be causes that are not related to neurodegeneration. It could be related to causes not that serious, but it could also indicate early neurodegenerative diseases in the elderly population is a pretty common and serious health concern.
So in the jigsaw puzzle of research, here's this piece, and now it's time to forge ahead and find the next piece.
Exactly. The poor sense of smell, I think, is kind of interesting because unlike vision impairment or hearing impairment, is often not recognized by people that had a poor sense of smell.
That's true. It's probably so subtle you don't realize you've lost it.
Exactly.
So is that something we should see incorporated into regular health screenings?
I think it's also a little bit too early to say about it. And again, until we understand the potential health implications associated with a person's smell, we probably should be cautious in making our recommendations. But, you know, in the long run, I would not be surprised your doctor is interested in testing your sense of smell at your follow-up.
Well, and thanks to your research, which was published in the journal Annals of Internal Medicine, they now know. Hong Li Chen is a professor in epidemiology and biostatistics at Michigan State University. It was great to talk with you about your work, and we want to thank you for taking time with us.
Very nice talking to you. Thank you so much.
The 2019 FIFA Women's World Cup kicks off this Friday in France, and the U.S. women's national soccer team will be chasing rare back-to-back titles. This U.S. team's the most successful of all the teams in women's international soccer, with 3 Women's World Cup titles, 4 Olympic gold medals, and a whole lot more. Andre Markowitz teaches comparative politics and German studies at the University of Michigan, but he's here today as a serious student of soccer, or as the rest of the world calls it, football. His newest book is Women in American Soccer and European Football, Different Roads to Shared Glory. Welcome back. So good to see you again,
Thank
Andre.
You. So nice to be here.
Why'd you choose this topic for your book?
I've always been interested, actually, in the issue of democracy, meaning to me, democracy is a constant and never-ending process of inclusion and of including formerly excluded people, or not only people, actually now my most recent work is actually on animals and animal rescue. And I was always interested, of course, in sports and soccer. And so the predecessor to this book was actually a book called Sportista, Female Fandom in the United States. I think you had me on for it.
We talked about it
exactly,
here.
Exactly.
Yes.
And so that then propelled me to look at soccer in a world in which it was, until the early 1970s, totally marginalized. And in some ways, it still remains that. But I was interested in how, again, how this is part of a larger process of inclusion and democratization.
All right.
And I see the world actually is getting better, not worse.
Well, so that's a good thing. I love that choice in the title, Different Roads to Shared Glory. And certainly, soccer has a vastly different cultural association here in America as compared to how Europeans view football. It's so much newer here in this country compared to Europe. Did that give women here a chance to really make their mark on the sport?
Yes, but differently. The story of the book is basically as follows. American women actually enter into a space which is really completely unoccupied. The word soccer is not known and it's not common until the 1980s, 1990s. And so women actually in the United States are not only pioneers as women in the sport of soccer, but in fact, for the culture of soccer, meaning that if you were to write a book on American soccer, history of American soccer, you simply could not write it without having 2 or 3 major chapters on the women. They are the carriers of the sport.
And you think of the stars. You think of names like Mia Hamm and Brandi Chastain and Abby Wambach and so many more. People know those names.
Absolutely. Julie Foudy,
yeah,
who is a major public figure in the United States. Absolutely.
Absolutely. Carly Lloyd. And stop and think, could many people name any of the men's players?
I don't know many. Certainly people who are into the men's world, certainly.
But these women are known to the general public.
I agree with you.
Yeah.
I agree with you.
Yeah.
Maybe Landon Donovan would be,
mm-hmm,
or maybe...
You're reaching.
No, because
yes.
I could name you a lot of men,
yeah,
but I'm just not sure who among them would be known to the rest,
yes,
of the public.
Agreed.
So contrary to this, in Europe, the women enter this world, which of course was completely occupied rather than open, by arguably the most male construct of anything other than the Catholic Church. So in fact, the struggle is different, but in both cases, very serious. In the United States, the struggle is for women to establish importance in something that Americans didn't care about. In Europe, it's for women to struggle into something which, in fact, men are completely live, die, and eat and drink and do everything.
They do.
And
they
so
do.
That is, yeah, a very, very, very different trajectory. But my argument in the book is that by virtue of the national teams and by virtue of the World Cup, there has in fact emerged a kind of convergence of the two, meaning that this World Cup for the first time will be a fairly big deal also in Europe. The French are into it. The Germans are into it. The English, who completely, a couple of years ago, this was seen as yet another form of American deformation, another form of America subverting our beautiful culture. You know, American girls playing, what is that? I mean, it was completely seen as not only kind of inappropriate, but in fact, even dangerous, undermining something. This has changed. So the England team has, since their good showing in the previous World Cup in Vancouver, this has become a big deal, and people will follow it. And so, in fact, on the national scale, women's soccer has arrived. Where it has not arrived, and where I see it struggling for the next 50 or so years, is on the club level.
Club level, okay.
Yeah, I'm meaning, look, on the national level, it's very simple. We have a ready-made fan base. It's called nationalism. Everybody feels American. Everybody feels German. Everybody feels English.
So whether it's the Olympics, whether it's the Gold Cup, we're all going to cheer.
Exactly.
USA.
Exactly. Yeah. It's what I call about soccer in America, not only women's soccer, what I call the Olympianization of the sport, meaning that actually in America, unlike in Europe and in Latin America, in the United States, soccer is Olympianized. It's only big every 4 years for the World Cup.
It's now, not like clubs where you go to Europe and you live and die by the club you support.
Unfortunately, it's even what you say is almost literally true.
It is true.
Exactly.
Yes.
And so on that level, the women's game is still nowhere near it. Basically, again, I have in the book that women's club games in Europe attract 1,400 people, 1,500. In the U.S., it's slightly higher, but not much. But there's a very interesting outlier, which are the Portland Thorns. I call it in the book, Portland is the epicenter of the world's women's club soccer. They draw 14 to 16,000 fans every club game, which I find fascinating. I have to research it.
Yeah, so that's to be determined. And yeah. One might argue, if you're talking about women's basketball, is this pretty similar?
It's similar. It's a very good analogy. The women's basketball in the United States is analogous to the women's football in Europe, meaning that the women in America entered into a space that was completely occupied by men. However, everyone knew about basketball. So, in fact, it's a different cultural mission. In soccer, the American women literally created and were the pioneers of an entire sport. In basketball, the women are entering a hitherto completely male world, very complicated, but also, of course, trailblazers in their own right, but in a different context. So it's a very different mission that they really have.
Interesting. I do have to ask you about the news. A women's national U.S. team recently sued U.S. Soccer Federation for gender discrimination. They're saying, wait a minute, institutionalized sexism has meant they're not paid as much, their training conditions are not as good as the men's team. What do you make of this lawsuit?
Oh, I think the lawsuit is long overdue. Or put it differently, I think it shouldn't even come to the lawsuit. Here's the story. The national teams are owned, quote unquote, by the federations, which means that they're not part of a market, okay? So since the men's and the women's teams are employees, again, in quotation marks, of the federation or are paid by the federation, there's absolutely no reason that they should not be paid exactly the same. Apart from the fact that indeed, in this case, as you in your introduction showed, the American women are far and away the most successful in the world, the men, let's just say, less so. But apart from that, they should be paid exactly the same and have the exact same condition. Unlike in the club world. See, in the club world, that's a market story.
Sure.
So clearly, if you play for the Portland Thorn, you cannot exact the same amounts of billions of dollars as if you play for Manchester United or Barcelona. It's just a different story. But in terms of the
national team,
which is the team of a federation, the remuneration should be exactly level.
Do you know if the national teams for women in Europe, do they have similar complaints?
Same complaints. Mm. All same, similar complaints.
So but the American women are leading the way here.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes. The American women are leading the way here too. Basically, in Europe, too, it took a long time for it to be taken seriously, and in some ways it still isn't, as I argue in the book. For example, to this day in Germany, they always refer to Frauenfußball, which, of course, is women's football, but they never call it Männerfußball. It's just Fußball.
Mm-hmm.
So it's understood to be the game is, in fact, a men's world.
And then you put that little icing on the cake
exactly.
if it's played by
exactly.
the women.
Exactly, exactly.
You want to go out on a limb and make a prediction? Do you think the U.S. women will successfully defend their World Cup title?
They should, and I, God knows I hope they will. But, you know, it's a big, big thing to play in the bastion of a very good country. And I'm very, very seriously considering the French to be a major contender. They're very good, and they're playing at home. And in the home field advantage in soccer is actually bigger than in any other team sport. So I think the French are very serious contenders.
University of Michigan professor Andre Markovitz, his newest book is Women in American Soccer and European Football, Different Roads to Shared Glory. It's always great talking football with you. Thank you, Andy.
Thank you so much, Cynthia. Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Peg Watson. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.